Welcome to the Fieldcrafts for All podcast. I'm your host for this episode. My name is Kevin Estella. I'm a director of training here in Aberdeen, North Carolina. And we had a little bit of technical difficulties in the previous recording. I literally just recorded what you just heard and it cut out. So you just heard it for the second time. Hopefully it was better. Guys, this podcast is going to be a fun one because my guest is someone who he and I, we go back a long time. We're talking 2006. And, you know, I'm going to share a little story, then I'll give the introduction. Just imagine that there's a product testing weekend, which was put on by a mutual friend in Marion, North Carolina. Now, this product testing weekend was basically created because there were a lot of guys on the early days of the online discussion boards that would talk a big game. They would say, oh, I can do this and I can do that. And our mutual friend, Terrell, basically said, if you can do that, why don't you come here and show us, right? Practice what you preach. So I get down to North Carolina after explaining to my parents at the time that I'm driving to North Carolina from Connecticut to hang out in the woods with a bunch of dudes and play with guns and knives. And, you know, of course, they think I'm crazy. And
that you met on the internet, too.
Yeah, that
you
I met,
say that you met them on the internet.
That I met on the internet. And as a result, you know, I meet this guest that I have on here named Joe Flowers. Now, Joe, at the time on his discussion board handle name, or his discussion board handle name was Joezilla, and he still goes by Joezilla in a lot of circles. And, you know, I meet Joe and I'm like, damn, this dude is wild. Like, he is all sorts of energy and he's got a lot of love for machetes. And I mean, we did some dumb things together, including possibly getting into a little too much moonshine one night, but we'll get to that. But in any case, since then, right, Joe and I have remained friends all these years. We bumped into each other in the airport. We've seen each other at trade shows. Like, it's like we never left the campfire. You know, we just pick up wherever we left off. But since Joe and I met in North Carolina years and years ago, Joe has started Bushcraft Global, which is a really cool company that takes people on bushcraft trips to Latin America. And Joe has worked as a product designer for Condor Knife and Tool. And he and I, you know, our paths are running very parallel to one another. And again, a lot of fun and a lot of respect for Joe and all he's doing. A lot of good time. So with that being said, I'm highly caffeinated too, and I've been running around trying to fix our recorder. I want to introduce you to Mr. Joe Flowers. Joe, how you doing, buddy?
Good. How about you, man? I'm glad to hear you're caffeinated as well.
Oh, man. I'll tell you that you got to have caffeine here at Fieldcraft. I mean, there's always something new. The company is a different company every single day. And, you know, like my day started off this morning at 5. I was making some PowerPoints for an upcoming course that we have called Bug Out Planning, which is going to be badass. And then, I'm revising our LandNav PowerPoint with actual photos from our training. So it's very real. People are seeing the gear and some of the stuff that they're going to be doing in the PowerPoint. But then tonight I'm doing Responsible Citizen, which that's a class that goes from like 6 until 7:30. And I'm talking about like, hey, you are getting all this training. This is what it takes to be a responsible citizen, a good member of society, all that stuff. Dude, I'm going to have a long ass day. It's one of those long ass days. But how about yourself? What do you got today?
Well, I'm hoping this will be a wonderful break for you. I'm definitely not doing self-defense against three-legged squirrels in the middle of the North Carolina, you know, mountains. Like we had to do that one time.
Yeah. And, you know, the chronic squirrel wasting disease that Ethan Becker, you know, tried to convince you about, which I think I still have the photo of you like in shock when he's like, you didn't eat the spine, did you? But we'll talk about that one in a bit. So let's kind of catch everyone up to speed, sure, with where you are now, and then we'll work our way back and all the way forward. So kind of tell us who you are and what you do.
Sure. So my name is Joe Flowers. I'm a zoology major, but I'm not employed in academia right now, being up in the mountains of North Carolina. But I have an entomology minor, so I like creepy crawlies and stuff like that. Also a big knife user and a knife lover, which, you know, kind of comes back to the forum days back when we all started on, knife forums and blade forums, you know, meeting other people who are as crazy as we are about the outdoors. And wrote, much like you did, Kevin, for a bunch of different magazines, and very, very parallel, like what you said, that kind of picked up for me. And I started to design for knife companies. I designed for Condor Tool Knife, Tops, Artisan Cutlery, CGRB, Work Tough, and a few others that'll come out, you know, maybe this year, without, you know, counting chickens before their eggs are hatched. And also with, I don't know, loving creepy crawlies and zoology, kind of worked with an affinity for going out into the bush and having a reason to use knives to go out farther. So, you know, North Carolina, South Carolina, Aberdeen, kind of where you're at, there's a huge place called the Sand Hills, which is a ridiculous ecosystem that actually I have a lot of history in doing snake research. But and basically all of that kind of attracted me to the jungle. I mean, Kevin, that's where you get to use a machete. And mm-hmm. you get to see a whole bunch of stuff, you know, crawling around. Unlike Connecticut, you know, which scares the living daylights out of me. I'm much more happy in the jungle where it's nice and hot. And like to learn from people who are out in the bush who really use a knife way more than I do. And I think that's kind of reflected a lot on my trips that I've been taking on. The trips I've been going for almost about a decade. I think it might be 2024 where we're at 10 years. Things have picked up. I do media consulting for shows and stuff down in the jungle, private trips, and then, of course, the big trip and other stuff internationally as well. So, like, Central America, South America is my place to go to, but every once in a while, I get a chance to go to Europe and learn about the whole European bushcraft scene. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, that's basically, in a nutshell, what everything is going. Oh, and Godzilla fan, hence Joezilla. So, yeah, rampant man. Godzilla fan, too.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize, and I don't think they appreciate what it takes to run a course internationally. Like I ran one course over in the UK in, I think it was 2013, no, 2012. Mm-hmm. And then I ran another one over there in 2013. And to get around like airline restrictions and then the legality of having certain things, like it, you have to have someone on the ground ahead of the time to do the advance and all that. It's not easy. So for you to be able to do that, not only in a foreign country, but a foreign country that doesn't speak the same language that we do here as like the majority language, the common language, it's impressive. You know, it really is.
You know, the hardest part for me, Kevin, is logistics, especially for Americans and mm-hmm. getting them down there, because, you know, as me, as being, you know, so used to traveling, I expect like things to happen a certain way. So there's a level of like uncertainty when you go out of, you know, this bubble that's North America or to, well, the U.S. Honestly, you're, you know, worried about, okay, is my backpack going to get there and all that stuff too. And that's been a whole training process in of itself, is to not be so dependent, you know, on all my equipment that I'm bringing down there, which is kind of crazy from a gearhead, you know, coming through with saying that. But that's the hardest part of logistics, honestly. I think you do a lot with logistics too, honestly.
Oh my God, dude. When you got to figure out what you can source locally so you don't have to fly with it, and what you can, you know, leave behind because, you know, someone on the ground might have something for you. Like right now, in a couple of days, I'm leaving for the Pacific Northwest to do a course in Seattle or north of Seattle. And, you know, I'm weighing my bag, double checking my bag. And, you know, obviously I don't want to, you know, just put everything on the company and be like, well, here, check five bags, you know, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't think a lot of people realize, like, you can go to a hardware store and get a lot of really good materials for teaching. You can go to a, if there is a Walmart, you can go to a Walmart or a Target, you know, and you can get not only food, but again, resources. And, you know, obviously there's places like thrift stores. Like you might go to a thrift store when you travel to a new location and save, you know, a whole bunch on stuff that people are getting rid of at their house that you can use. And then you don't necessarily have an emotional attachment. You just leave it, you know, leave it with the people you're training with.
You know, I'm going to, everybody on the podcast, I'm going to make a confession here. This year when I saw you at the airport, when we just kind of bumped into each other,
yeah,
that was the first time in probably 5 years I haven't traveled with a knife. And every single time, yeah, guys, I pay for the extra baggage to check in my luggage to make sure I can bring, you know, like a knife and 50 machetes.
Yep.
But that was the first time. And it was honestly just for me personally, it was almost stress relieving, just having my mm-hmm. baggage with me and then going down there and have to improvise. Now, guys, I have to say this, but the person who I met at the airport is a custom knife maker. So he had me already kitted up before I got down there. But, you know, it really like opened my eyes of, you know, what do I need to take with me? What do I need? Do I need skills or do I need equipment? You know, and mm-hmm. and it was very, very refreshing. I don't think I could do it again when I have clients, but like it was cool that time.
Yeah, it's an awkward feeling when you fly unarmed.
It really
you know?
Is.
And I mean, I'm used to flying with pistols and rifles and things like that for hunting and fishing trips abroad and elsewhere. But when you fly without a knife, which I had to do last year for the first time when I had to rush back home to my mom, who was you know, passing away, I had stuff in my old bedroom I knew I could go to. And I always have like a bag of gear, you know, that I keep in my old childhood you know, home. But it is a weird feeling because there's always that pucker factor when you go through the airport, like, man, am I going to forget that I have something in a pocket? Or
Yeah. Do I have a 38 in there?
Yeah.
Or, you know, God knows what.
And Josh Smith of Montana Knife Company, he just posted, he was flying out to Winter Strong at Bert Soren's place. And he posted that his wife had one of their like skinny, you know, speed goats in her bag. And TSA was like really nice about it. He's like, I probably will have to pay a few fines, but they were really cool about it. Like she didn't get, you know, tossed and searched and whatnot beyond what they had to do at the secondary. But, it's scary, man. Sometimes when you fly, you're like, did I take everything out? Which, I mean, that's the protocol. Go through every single pocket, go through and check to make sure that you're not carrying anything that could potentially be like a gun part or a spare round or a loose knife or whatever it is, you know? So, and it's gotta be even unnerving. Like you're flying, your courses are primarily Latin America and in particular Peru, right? Or is it somewhere else?
Peru, Brazil, and Colombia. More or less Colombia is my area of operation. And then we kind of go across the road, across the Amazon River to Peru. And then we also operate in Brazil where some of the indigenous I work with are. But yeah, we do go into Peru too.
So let's talk about that. And then obviously I want to talk about your upbringing and everything like that. So you go over to Peru and you're going to Latin America. Let's talk about your first course that you ran down there and maybe like kind of give some insight into what it takes to run a program. Because common question that we always get is what does it take to become an instructor? What does it take to, you know, monetize what you love to do? So kind of talk us through your first course that you ran down there and maybe some of the lessons learned.
Well, for me personally, it took a very patient wife. But besides that, you know, getting down there, I kind of was like thrown into this a little bit more, honestly, just thrown into it rather than, hey, I think I want to start to become a jungle instructor, Kevin. Mm-hmm. When I went down there, the situation was I went down there on an expedition with another person who wasn't doing like a training expedition. He was doing a money raising thing to go from one side of the South America to the other. And when I got down there, this poor gentleman had dengue fever. So a very long story short, I had to take over the whole expedition. And because I had taken previous training with previous good classes with a, you know, like a reputable source, Essie Knives. It was mm-hmm. my first time out in the jungle in, I think, 2009. When I was down in Peru, when I was down in Colombia and Brazil in 2011, I was able to take some of the aspects of training that I learned from, you know, previous courses that I paid for, and I was able to apply it to that whole situation. So I was able to take over the whole expedition while he was in the hospital and other aspects. And while I was down there, you know, here's Joe losing his mind because he's in the middle of a jungle town, which is a pretty big town, Leticia, Colombia, which is on the border of Brazil, Peru, and Colombia, kind of like a triangle. They call it the tri-corners. And I was like, guys, Joe wants to go look for snakes. Where does he go? Because, you know, I'm in the middle of town. And so I go to this one area. They're like, Joe, stay the night. You know, I see all these amazing animals on a night hike, like spiders as big as my hand, Kevin, crazy colored squirrels, possums the size of mice, and all the stuff. And I'm just like completely awestruck. I haven't seen this stuff ever since I was a kid watching like Discovery Channel, but like I never saw it in person. So I knew, you know, as far as like machetes and knives and creepy crawlies, this was a habitat that was very open to it. And so I wake up in the morning, get out of my hammock and go to the main area. And this Arnold Schwarzenegger Serbian guy comes out and goes, yo, dude, what do you do? And I'm like, well, I design knives and write about knives. And he's like, holy crap, I make knives. And so I get to know him more. He shows me some of the knives he made. He has no knowledge of what the word bushcraft is or anything like that. You know, this is just a Monday for them. He goes, yeah, I've got all these fire by friction stuff from the tribesmen I learned from. And so he goes, man, I'd really like to show some of these skills to other people. And I'm like, okay, you know, let me meet them and maybe we can do something here. So I drag a herpetologist, a reptile and amphibian scientist with me, who's one of my best friends, down there the next year. And we get to meet some of the tribesmen. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, this is incredible. The trip was incredible. We still have a frog new to science we think that we have to look up and get processed and all that fun stuff. But after that, I'm like, you know, to my friend Gordon, Tanaboca Knives, I'm like, gosh, I think we really have something here. Can we do this logistically, you know, and correctly? And he's like, okay, let's try it. And so the first year we have five people come down there, and then it's become bigger ever since. And actually this year I haven't even started advertising the dates yet, but I'm almost full and I need to actually advertise the dates for it, but it's kind of gotten bigger. But what I think people, you know, think that you can just jump into this and go. And I don't think they realize like the amount of work that like we both have decades of writing experience, or even a published author in a book. And, you know, that also amounts to something rather than, oh, I just learned this on the internet and now I just want to go ahead and get paid teaching it.
Right, right.
You know, and I think that's hard too. And well, I mean, it's very hard to make a very a good living doing this stuff. So trying to measure yourself with other survival instructors or people out there is something different. For me, I don't consider myself so much a teacher, although I do teach classes. I try and bring them down for an experience where they're forced to teach in these situations, forced to learn in these situations. And if they ever need a tap out, oh, okay, yeah, this is how you do the hammock knot. Okay, Alberto, can you come here and explain why, you know, his mosquito net's kind of weird? Because it'll just sound like an American talking about it this way. But, oh, you know, your toes are touching the screen. That's where the mosquitoes will come suck the blood right out of your toe and stuff. So, you know, you learn more context that way. For me, it's worked well in my aspect, I think.
Yeah, to your point about, you know, just jumping into it, that is a common thought is, hey, you know, mm-hmm. I've done this, you know, I can just do it, or I'm really interested in this topic, I should just start teaching it. And granted, there is going to be a time where you don't have experience and you are a brand new person teaching it, and you might have skills, just not the experience. And you're going to go through that like mental rep of everyone thinks I'm a fake, everyone thinks I'm a phony. But if you can back it up with skill, kind of like Terrell's event, guess what? You know it better than the guy that just knows it in theory.
Right.
You know, but the problem is that there are so many online instructors these days who, if you were to say, well, show me 5 years ago your interest in this topic, right? And you find out that they don't have it even 4 years ago. And, you know, I just had this conversation with some folks. I'm like, you look at someone at a PhD level, they have 4 years of college, they have probably a master's degree and then a doctorate, which at a minimum is probably 7 to 9 years of advanced mm-hmm. study. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, a PhD is necessarily an expert in anything. They're very knowledgeable. But if you apply that same time standard to learning any skill, right, like a PhD boyer, right, or a PhD botanist, or a PhD canoeing instructor, so to speak, right, with 7 years of experience, that's better than the person who has four, and is definitely better than the person who has taken up an interest in the past 2 years. And now they say that they're a pro, and it's like, you only have 2 years under your belt. And again, there are the outliers. There are those folks out there who are really, really talented, and they get into something and they crush it, and God bless them. But those are the exceptions to the rule. Now, your experience, like, I love the fact that you are learning from the locals and you let the locals do a lot of the instruction, because, I mean, it's more genuine. You know, like I can show a Siberian hitch and explain, hey, this is a great knot that you can use when you have mittens on. But yeah. I think when you watch a video, or if you're in the presence of someone who's done it because they live in Siberia, or, you know, they live in a climate where, you know, that it is just part of their life. You know, maybe they don't necessarily explain it really well, but they can demonstrate it better than anyone because it's so part of their routine and it's authentic. You know what I mean? So like the folks that you're learning from, and you're bringing the people to have those awesome experiences with, I mean, these are people that grew up around machetes, and I know you're
right. First thing they wake up in the morning, they're not checking Instagram or whatever. They're actually fixing thatches on their house and stuff.
Yeah. In the machete life, you know, a common question that comes up that we get all the time is, what's an appropriate age to give someone a knife? And I say, well, it doesn't have to do with age. It has to do with maturity. Cause I know plenty of mm-hmm. people who are technically adults that I don't trust with a knife, right? They're just not mature. They're grown men that are men children, you know? But down in Latin America, like, I remember, do you remember Ron Hood's video, the jungle survival one?
Oh gosh. Yeah. Yeah. That was one of my inspirations for going down there.
Yeah. And he he carried around the bussy battle mistress, and, you know, he was stabbing caimans through the head. But there's the video, and I used to show this as a teacher. There's a video of like the little girl and little boy, and they're skinning the rat.
Yeah, and they're sharpening the knife on that convex sharpener, and they just kind of feel it and go. Yep. And I'm like, dang, not even the adults here know how to do that.
Exactly.
Oh, I get off on that, man. I think that's amazing in a good way, not in a bad way.
Yeah.
But, you know, phrasing. But I think that's so amazing. I've learned more from a five-year-old who's way better at using a cutting tool than I am.
Yeah, because it's part of their life. And I mean, and you know, the flip side of the coin is maybe it's kind of sad, you know, because that's their existence. You know, like they know that, but they don't necessarily know, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic, because that's not the world that they live in. But then again, I mean, do they need to know that to exist where they are? Probably not. So, you know, it's always interesting, like when you look at something, you know, what lens are you looking at it through? Are you looking at it through like the perspective of someone who wants to do what they're doing from the educator perspective? You know, like, I think those folks that live in the jungle are some of the hardest, toughest people out there. And, you know, when we're worried about, oh, you know, I've got insect repellent for this and head netting and this and that, they're walking around shirtless, you know, like,
yeah,
those dudes are tough. Those women are tough. Well, those kids are tough.
You know, for the jungle, I think that's one of the biggest positive things I get from it is the perspective change.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause everybody thinks, you know, down there is going to be green hell and it's going to be this, that, and the other. And I just had to go down to Eglin Air Force Base with the 7th Group Special Forces for a jungle symposium, just as a instructor, talker, speaker. And that's something that they were much more interested in was the perspective change. We've learned about all of the jungles, all this, that, and the other. By the end, depending on the environment we're at, how much we've cleaned it out and how much everybody's comfort level it is, a lot of times the clients who become friends afterwards are even out there bare shirt and even in the camp where we've done all the trimming and all that are barefoot because they've learned, you know, hey, this place is incredible. This isn't nearly as bad as what I've read about in, you know, the Jungle Book or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, that's one of the reasons me personally, I'm interested to go up into really, really cold places because I think I could have that perspective change about me being a baby, about being out in cold places too.
Yeah. You know, something, man, it's like, I know there are people out there that say that you know, you should get as much training as you can. You know, one perspective is learn jungle, learn desert, learn saltwater, learn Arctic, right? And it does provide a lot of, you know, clarity into what you do. And then there are people that say, well, you should only focus on where you're training. And it's like, okay, I understand that one. I don't think there's really a correct answer at this point, you know?
Oh yeah. Good point. Yeah.
But you know something, I will say that like my experience in the jungle isn't as extensive as yours, but the times that I've gone to different jungles, right? Like Grenada, mm-hmm. in Costa Rica, in Hawaii, and you know, there are so many commonalities when you do go to those jungles, you're like, oh, I've seen this plant before. And you know, Marty Simon, he used to say,
yeah, of course.
Yeah. He used to say that plants follow lines of latitude. And when you look at where some of those areas are, you know, they all fall on pretty much the same line of latitude, give or take, you know, a handful of degrees. But I mean, what is the most useful jungle plant that you've learned about?
Oh gosh, there's a billion.
I know. I know there are. I know.
Honestly, let's see, a palm. Palms are really, really, really useful because you can eat them. You can process them for cordage. You can process them for fire starting. You can process them for shelter. They're like bamboo. They're like a super plant. And when you learn these palms, you'll learn aspects about the palms in the jungle that I kid you not, I was able to use on palmettos in South Carolina and stuff too. And when you learn, kind of like how Marty used to teach over back in North Carolina when he do the plant walks and stuff. When you learn the aspects about a plant and what to use for, you can translate that to wherever you're at. So, you know, you're in Aberdeen, South Carolina, but I could go up to California and I'm still going to be surrounded by pine trees to the point where I'm almost in trouble if I don't have fat wood lying around everywhere, you know, to process. And I think that was the cool part, learning the aspects of the plants and which parts to exploit and to take off like a palmetto or a thatch palm and go, hey, okay, I can't get cordage out of this, but good gosh, there is a green center I can eat for heart of palm and stuff for different plants. So I definitely have to say palm because it taught me a lot about how tropical and how neat they are.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I bring up Marty's name and I've talked about like my dad being, you know, a key figure and my late friend, Chris Sayoc. Who would you say like was your greatest inspiration for learning skills as a kid?
Well, definitely as a kid and up until, you know, maybe in college when I started hanging out with Steve Watts from the Shield Museum would have been my dad, because he had a heavy, I think Marty did too. They both went to Vietnam, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And he had, he was a captain and he was a CAP officer. So Civilian Action Patrol, they used to throw him behind enemy lines and they would teach small villages and stuff, you know, what to do. And so it was a really, really small group, but he was really good at improvising and, you know, taught me how to stitch, stalk, and you know, do a lot of stuff in the areas I was at that I learned from. His knife skills weren't so great, but he made it up with everything else too. I mean, he's able to fillet a fish, no problem. I still can't fillet a fish like him, but like, you know, everything else, he was just like, yeah, okay, you're whittling a point. They used to use those for punji stapes. We didn't have to, you know, do this, that, and the other, but I would definitely say my dad. And then of course, you know, the myriad of movies that I watched when I was a kid. But, you know, there is that aspect of having respect for elders who have been and seen a lot more stuff than I have.
Yeah. And jumping back to the most recent encounter we had, you were actually going back to the jungle to attend a funeral, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And well, it's a tribesman's friend. We actually called him Beast Mode Bushcraft. He's probably the oldest tribesman or the person I've known the longest. His name is Alberto. No secret. He loves showing off his tops 130. That's completely beat all to heck. Looks like it went through a concrete grinder, guys. This is a Topps machete that he's had for like 10 years, put together with like vines and stuff, because he's just not accepted that the jungle wants to take it back. And so it's always like a process of seeing how much this thing has aged. But his wife of 38 years old passed away, and so I just went down there to go hang out with them. You know, make sure all that stuff is doing okay. But, you know, he really knew his jungle stuff too. And I've been dealing with him since 2013 or something like that. And so, you know, he's just a good friend who you want to help support.
And what's the name of the tribes that you're dealing with primarily down there?
Well, it's starting to pick up, because word goes, this sounds narcissistic, but word gets out that we just pay them for having a Monday in the jungle. But so the Yukuna tribe, which is Alberto, they're more modern. Hui Toto, they're also more modern. They're in that region. The Makuna, or I'm sorry, the Tikuna, that's actually one of my main translators for the more primitive tribes. There is another tribe who's way more recent, and I have to remember because he was new last year, but he's more of just like he considers himself more of just a bushman and water guy than tribal, because they went like, you know, maybe 200 years ago, they got assimilated. But the big one that I work with is the Métisse tribe. The Métisse were first contacted in the late 1970s, 1980s. They've been all over the front of National Geographic. They're from Brazil. When we're allowed to work with them, they come out of Brazil and work with us, but they're like the bodyguards for the uncontacted tribes in the reservation in Brazil, where, you know, the Métisse guides can tell you about the time before metal, the time before clothes, the time when they would find, you know, machetes and think that they were sacred objects and stuff. And I work with those men, not like the second generation, as much as I can down there as well. So we have like a mix of primitive and new tribes. The more modern tribesmen, like the one I just talked about, Beast Mode Bushcraft, Alberto, he shows you how to make stuff and can explain the, you know, the importance of making this pottery, making this basket, making this trap, fishing with a machete. Whereas the Métisse are, now that I've had a good working relationship within the past 3 or 4 years, they've gotten better at teaching, but they used to just do all demo and stuff too, because they didn't know that they were supposed to teach it. And it's kind of like a rough thing. They don't speak any written language, so it's a little bit easier to translate, or a little bit harder to translate with them what to do, but it's worked out a lot better. And we've had the Métisse requesting to come back to us year after year, and they have to draw straws now to see which tribes we get to come down. Mm-hmm. So it's worked out great.
You know, it's been what, 24 years, maybe 25 years since Ron Hood did the trip to the jungle. And you know,
good
that video.
Gosh, has it been that long? Yeah, 25 years?
Yeah, I just pulled it up on my computer here. They said 98.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to watch that later on today.
Yeah, 98, 99. And I'm just curious, like, you know, continuity and change over time. You know, you remember that video as much as I do. Did you have any of those experiences like he had? And for the listener who has never seen this video, like they show up and word got to the village before he got to the village that they were coming. And then the second thing is the locals had never seen themselves in like the monitor of the video camera. And, you know, there were all these like little nuances of like people who were isolated. And I'm just wondering, like, did you have any of those experiences where you're like, oh, that happened to Ron Hood too?
Yeah, almost yearly. Honestly, almost yearly, to the point where I'm realizing, at least with the Métis tribe, I'm on a limited time span with them, Kevin, because, you know, we're talking with these guys who they're graduate students who can't figure out how old they are. And they stopped at 70. And meanwhile, Iban's freaking three stories up in the tree just to get some acai stuff and all that. And it's the same guy. And this was like 5 years ago that they just said, oh, we think he might be around 70 or it's 79. We're not sure. But like from 1 year to another, for instance, they wear a lot of bands and stuff to show that they're a different tribe from the other. It's actually a identification to make sure, you know, if they have to fight other tribes, because there's still other intertribal warfare in the region where they're at, not so much for the Métis anymore, but there used to be. So they wear, you know, all these bands to show that they're different from the other tribes. And they always made it from this traditional material called chambira, which is from Astrocarium chambira. It's just basically called the chambira palm tree. And they always made it out of this like classic, like light brown looking bracelets. And then 1 year I got there and they had all these pink bracelets and all these white bracelets all made out of cotton and all these multicolored, you know, like Brazilian flag and Colombian flag, like straight from last year. And, you know, I asked them, you know, guys, what's up with this? And I'm like, oh, well, we hear that tourists like this more. And, you know, it's not me to make that decision or anything else. I'm, you know, let them adapt, do whatever they want. That is not what we're about. But I told them for sure, I think the people that I brought on this trip will like the palm stuff more. And so the next trip, they brought the stuff that they're used to more for us. But that was happening. Like, I literally like called over to my friend, is this happening right now while I'm looking? He's like, yeah. And it was, you know, like, God knows how many thousands of years of them, you know, applying this amazing cordage material and then just going, oh, we found cotton. It was easier. Let's just do it this way.
Yeah.
And so you see a change just like that. I've had second gen contacted tribesmen of different tribes come down there and they're just not the same. They show us stuff, but we have to like force them to do stuff. Meanwhile, you know, like the first gen, pre-contact ones are like, yeah, we just got to the campsite. We're going to make an armadillo trap and this, that, and the other. And the second guys are just like, oh yeah, we got here. What are we eating and stuff too. And that's not the Métis tribe. That's just different tribes just together. But it was eerie seeing it change within a year.
Wow.
And it really does do that. I mean, you know, I used to, whenever the, some of the tribes would go back onto the river and all that, they would, just bring big blankets. Now they wear shirts and hats and stuff, and that's fine. That's absolutely fine. But you know, I can just see that change.
Have you encountered any of the issues? Like, I know people worry about, oh, I'm traveling down there, I need to be inoculated, this and that. And people think that the inoculations are for them from what they're going to encounter. But the reality is you're inoculating yourself to not give it to the locals. Have you heard of anything like that where people are like, I don't want to have any contact with you? And obviously, like, we just got over COVID, or I want to say we got over COVID. But I mean, what was that like doing business when like the world was shut down?
That, you know, that was difficult. And it's always any tribes first, and I'm not trying to get into that, guys, but we take all of the inoculations needed to go down there recommended by the government for each area. And for the tribes that I work with, we're not going with the super, like, there are some possibilities of working with some much more primitive tribes, but that's one step at a time to make sure everything's legal. The Métis, they get yellow fever inoculations, malaria, they get everything that we would get, because when they were first contacted in the 1980s, they sent, you know, missionaries heard about it and they, of course, went around there illegally and then killed about 300 of them. And there were only 50 left. And then, you know, they had to build up. And that's probably a whole horror story of a thing. But I don't know much about that because I was a kid at the time. But, you know, now they're much, much more robust for the most primitive tribe. The other ones, get inoculations when they can, or, you know, by, you know, by problems. Like, for instance, the funeral for the wife that I had to go down there for, that was just from a complication from malaria.
That's
what they think.
Wow. And but they don't have any, I mean, or what would be the normal remedy for that? Is it just the quinine?
No, for malaria, well, it depends. Doxycycline, quinine, and a couple of other over-the-counter antibiotics. But, you know, there is some there's still some questionable stuff with that situation. So I wasn't sure about exactly what happened. But it can onset fast with some people. And well, with the Matisse, not one. I think they're up to 300, 400 people in the tribe now. I'm not sure about that. Not one died from COVID.
Man, it's almost like it was almost like the flu.
Yeah,
you know, it's wow, you know.
So, well, I mean, for them, and
right,
and
right.
But you know, that being said, when I got down there to the village for the, or when I got down there to Leticia for the first time, you know, since COVID, there were three different shop owners I knew personally down there that passed away from it. So, you know, I saw that aspect. So I don't know what to say about that. There's some weird aspects of all that type of travel down there with us, you know, being even from people from UK or from all over the world. I've had Serbians come down like three times. The general, you know, antibiotics and stuff work. And as long as you're not, you know, like crazy into it. The worst parts, Kevin, are like near the cities where a lot of people are. That's where the malaria is. That's where you can get dengue. When you're in the bush, it seems like all the problems go away.
Yeah. Mark Knapp, I'm sure you met him at Blade Show. He's my buddy who I went to Alaska with. He always talks about the dirt up in the tundra as good dirt, you know, like, and you know, if you read Comfort Crisis, you know, the guy talks about how he didn't take a shower and, you know, he's got grime all over him, but it's basically not the same standard of cleanliness that you have in like your normal day to day here in civilization. And, you know, I think people, when they go to the jungle or they go to the tundra or they spend some time in the woods, they kind of just get comfortable with like, hey, that's my dirt. You know, that's my grime. I don't need to wash that spoon as much. Let me just do the pre-wash, lick it clean and call it a day. You know, like
that was PWIP when we would hang out, you know, back on Terrell's Hill in a nutshell. And I think maybe that's a cool aspect of trading, Kevin, is, you know, that's part of it, is you get more comfortable with yourself and what you're able to go through.
Let's talk about some of those practice what you preach stories, because there are some real gems. Man, I mean, I got to pull up these photos here. So you sent me some photos, and the first one that I pulled up was me with my buddy Nate. But then I scrolled down and I was like, oh my God, I forgot about that. Like, you know, I see year one, which for me, which was 2006. Then I see year two, which was 2007. Number one, in 2007, I'm like 200, probably 30 pounds in that photo. And I'm just like a beefcake. That's the only way I can describe myself. Like I'm girthy. And then I see the one of you with the squirrel, and I remember that squirrel. And I remember,
hey, what gun was that we took out? Testing that 410. What was it? 22.
That was made by CZ Firearms. It was sold through Springfield. It was the Scout. It was the M6 Scout. And I remember, you know, we found that squirrel, and the squirrel was hurt, right? Like, it had a gimpy leg. Something happened to it.
Maybe. No, guy, the audience, it was angry. It was coming right at us. It was screaming, frothing at the mouth. It had a chainsaw.
Yep. And I remember, you know, on Terrell's property, he's like, oh, I've got this line that's like a trap line. I go small game hunting there. So the two of us struck out, and I've got, you know, I had my Bark River, Fox River knife on me. I had my Glock 21. I had this M6, like I might've well been taken on the world with everything that I had with me. And you show up and you got a machete. And I remember you were walking like 5 or 10 feet in front of me through this little bit of a draw. And we see this squirrel, and we're like, no way, you know, because the whole point of the weekend is to, you know, catch the fish out of the pond.
We're like, oh, we got a chance to do that.
Yeah. So now we see the squirrel that's kind of gimpy, and you're like, shoot it. And I'm standing there with this rifle shotgun combo, and I'm like, Joe, you're in the way, you know? And I was like, and you also have a machete, let's save ammo. And I remember, you know, well, we took it out. Let's just say that. And then the funny part of that story wasn't the fact that, you know, we showed up with a squirrel back in camp and people were like, whoa, they actually got one. It was when Ethan Becker, no, first it was George Hedgepeth.
That's it. He was the one doing the cleaning.
Yeah. Cleaned it. And as you know, when you clean a squirrel, you cut the back and you put two fingers in and you yank it apart. And that's the fastest way I found for cleaning them. And when he did it and he got to the leg, like it was like you took a jelly packet and squirted it on his chest full of like coagulated nasty blood. Remember that?
It was pus, like the worst zit ever, just explode all over him. Yeah. And I heard a look of disgust from him. And I was like, oh gosh, he must have opened up a bad egg or something. And I look over and he's like completely drenched in that.
Yeah, it was nasty. So then, you know, the funny part with that for me was, you know, now you put it inside of like a billy can. And for the listener, like a billy can isn't just like a pot. You know, I think yours was actually out of like a number 10 can, right? Like a...
Yeah. That's, you know, that's Ron Hood style,
yep,
you know, back in the days. Remember when he make them out of the coffee cans?
Yep, exactly. So you had that. And you're standing there and Practice What You Preach was an event where like you had industry guys there. So like Doug Ritter's there and, you know, Ethan Becker's there. And I'm trying to think of Dan, right? From Jerry.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Jerry is there. And, you know, you've got all these different companies. Jerry Young, you know, one of our instructors here, he's there with his dog.
Yeah, Jerry was there.
Yep. So now we're all standing
same
around.
Same haircut though, right?
Same haircut. Yep.
Okay. Yeah. I'm rolling that at some point here in the future.
So now you're drinking like the squirrel stew that you made and Ethan Becker decides to screw with you. And he goes, Joe, that's not a squirrel that you're eating. And you're like, oh yeah, it is. Like we were both like really excited for you. And, and then he's like, did you eat the head? And you're like, oh no, we cut it off. And then he goes, well, what about the spine? Is the spine in there still? And you're like, yeah, it's right here. And he goes, well, do you know about chronic wasting squirrel disease, CWSD? And we're like, what? Like, I was like, what the hell is that? And I could tell in a way,
too.
I could tell in a way because, you know, I see some of the others, like the elder, so to speak, you know, we're both in our 20s and I could see them kind of like chuckling, but you were like stone faced, like, oh my God, you know, like, and then he's like, I'm just messing with you. But Ethan Becker,
I think I was more flabbergasted that I didn't know about it. I was like, yeah, I'm a zoology major. Just talking with the wildlife officer yesterday. You know,
and brand new disease. squirrel wasting disease, which it would explain why the leg was all gimpy. But, you know,
oh, I'm looking at a picture of it right now. Audience, it is straight up a nasty squirrel leg in a coffee can put over a fire for fun.
Do you have that photo?
Yeah, I think I do. I can send it to you.
Yeah, you'll send it to me at some point. I gotta see that. I'll do a post this week about, you know, looking back at Practice What You Preach. But, you know, that was such a fun event. And I want to do something like that here in North Carolina with inviting folks down and being like, look, it's going to be a low cost event, like cover the cost of, you know, the land use, you know, wherever we decide to do it, cover the cost of the port-a-johns. And let's just get together, sit around the fire. Let's share some ideas. If any of the industry folks want to come out, like maybe I'll tap Spartan Blades because they're right here in Southern Pines.
Yeah. I know some great places in Aberdeen do that. I honestly would have started PWYP again, but like just for me personally, I would have been so worried. I know this, just me internally being, you know, not just a instructor, but like taking people around the world and stuff. I love being a host. That I knew that I would worry so much about the event that I'd be too busy trying to micromanage and make sure everybody else is having a good time.
Yeah.
I'll come to anybody else's big event they want though.
Yeah. It's a huge undertaking. Like you think about it, you could have a whole bunch of businesses send you stuff with the anticipation that there's going to be, you know, 100 people there. And,
right.
You know, you remember as well as I do with the day of the forums, we would put out like, oh, we're doing a winter camping trip or, hey, we're going down to Gossman Knives. And everyone and their mother would say, oh, I'm going to be there. Right. And this is the problem with training. And this is, okay, I'm going to get on my soapbox for a minute. When people say, oh, I'm going to train. It's like, okay, you're going to train. Oh, you're going to be there. Okay, great. And then you, as like a host or as a guest who wants to like buy stuff for the group, like, hey, I'll bring extra food for everyone. Well, now the guests are showing up expecting that there's going to be 15 people at this winter campout and there are 4 that show up. And now we have to throw away food or, you know, it that was one of my biggest pet peeves was people that just didn't follow through.
We had, long story short, Practice What You Preach. We stopped doing it because it got so big.
Yeah.
We had to cap it at 150 people.
Yeah.
And even then they were strangers and stuff. And even at some of these other events, for instance, last Georgia Bushcraft, we went over 1,000 people.
Jesus.
They get huge.
And then you know what happens, and you saw this, and I only went to two of them, but they get clicky, you know, where it's like the whole idea is one fire, right? Everyone sits around that one fire. Well, a lot of these events got to the point where it was like, oh, that group over there, they're going to sit by their fire. And then there's going to be another one over there. And, oh, we can't talk to that group over there. It's like, dude, there's no politics allowed here. Like, it's stupid, you know? So I don't know. I want to do one. I just worry that it's going to get to that point. I really hate the idea of running classes and having a bunch of folding chairs, you know, sit in the dirt, make a stump, you know, like, you know, find a stump and sit there. But I don't know. We'll see what this year,
you know, the biggest thing to keep it from getting clicky is just say, oh, it's going to be a trade blanket weekend. When all the gear gets put out that everybody has a, you know, ridiculous amount of, and everybody wants to start trading, it starts getting more fun.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, think about, you know, we went up to your neck of the woods back in the day up in, was it Pennsylvania? I know you were from Connecticut, but Pennsylvania?
Yeah, we went to Hawk Mountain.
Yeah, Hawk and St. Forest.
Yeah, Hawk Mountain Sanctuary. Yep, that was a fun one. I was just looking at photos from that the other day.
Oh gosh, that was great. I do remember getting like one gentleman having like 5 wheelbarrows full of stuff that he bought from like Cabela's or whatever. And I remember that, but that was just like, you know, trying to balance, you know, me just trying to keep a kid's feet cold or warm, you know, all the way to, you know, oh wow, we got to bring all this gear through.
Yeah. That was Dom. And he had one of those wheeled carts for pulling a deer out of the backcountry, and he had it loaded. And I remember like every one of us had like a GI canvas, like duffel bag on our shoulders. And I remember feeling it. And at one point, I think I looked over at like Tim Stetzer, or I looked over at Jerry or whoever was there. And I remember I was like, there's a brand new stove in here. I can feel it. And I like, it's still in cardboard. Like, and then I'm like, oh, and there's like 3 bottles of fuel. Like, what the hell did this guy carry? And I love Dom. Don't get me wrong. We've been on a bunch of campouts, but I was like, damn, you know, like, what about packing lightly?
Well, you know, that's the other thing too. Maybe some of these things is I haven't been, and honestly, I'm going to go on a side rant here. Mm-hmm. I haven't been challenged to do an ultra. I used to write for Backpacker Magazine, and I have been challenged tried to write or do like ultralight, less than 20-pound backpacking trip. Because me personally, I'm Joe Flowers. I write about knives. I need to take 50 machetes with me every time I go backpacking. And, you know, those were fun. I think Jerry and even Ed, you know, back in the day did I can't remember if you were there or not, the coffee can challenge.
Yep.
That was super fun. And, you know, sometimes that's just a way to be like, okay, you know, like the Dude McLean, Alan Halkin style of what's in your pockets challenge. I miss those.
Yeah. And then there was the, we did the Nessmuk challenge where everything had to be under 15 pounds. We did that in the Pennsylvania Grand Canyon, which is gorgeous. And then we did another sub 10 pound pack challenge up in Vermont at Ben LeGrand's property. That was 2014 or 2015. But I like those theme trips because, you know, it really is just an easy standard. It's like, okay, you could go to your vehicle. We're not going to say you can't, but for the spirit of the challenge, like, let's all just take a look at what you're carrying. Let's suck this up together and just have a good time. You know, I think maybe that's the way to do it to avoid those stupid lawn chairs showing up everywhere. So
I've got a bunch of lawn chairs now. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
You know, the funniest thing, as far as like trade good goes down in the jungle now, almost every time I bring one of those like cheap $30 Amazon camping folding chairs, not only because it pays for itself if we happen to like get stuck on one of the side rivers and, you know, have to, you know, get out and do that. Like I can have one of the clients sit down in that chair when their butts are, you know, falling asleep. But like, dude, the indigenous will trade anything for those. Mm-hmm. They're crazy about those. So like there is, you know, that whole like armchair, you know, aspect of it. I really like chairs now, but, you know, people used to get in fights back in the fur trade era over who could sit on a certain stump. And, you know, you got that all the way to armchair commandos now and all that. But there's a fine balance in between that. I think I really like, for instance, we had to stitch up the side of the armchair on our last trip, more or less, because there was a machete accident to the nylon and stuff, too, because people are, you know, able to carve in those smaller chairs, you know, to the side pretty safely and stuff, too. So, I mean, there's just a big aspect of just stuff that I learned, you know, since, gosh, 2006, you know, back in before the times of Instagram, you know, that I don't know, I felt more confident about now. Yeah. my armchair is one of those like things where I do unpack some other stuff in my jungle kit to put that thing in. But I don't come home with it because I end up, you know, giving it to somebody. But, you know, there's like things where I'm like, gosh, that wouldn't have been a problem up at PWIP because I could have just yanked something down and just sat on it.
Yeah, we could talk forever about, you know, we did this, we did that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And geez, I mean, there's a lot of history, right? I mean, we could do multiple podcasts. Maybe we will. But what I want to talk about real quick, because if you look up Joe Flowers and you look up Joe Flowers machete, Joe Flowers design, right? Like you're going to find a whole bunch of knives that you've made and whatnot. When I first met you, you were an Ontario machete guy who cut the D handle off of the D machete, sanded it down. You were there with like Bootlegger, right? And you guys were big into the machetes back in the day. But the thing that I want to talk about, because it's a skill set. I remember you were a big fan of melting PVC to make a quickie sheath. Can you talk the listener through that process?
Oh gosh, man. And you know, I think my designing is not I'm not a knife maker. All right. I will tell everybody that right to their face. I'm not great at making knives. Scott Gossman, all these other wonderful makers deserve way more respect. As far as designing goes, I was always a modifier for ergonomics and things like that, or just to get through crap really, really fast. And that's where the PVC pipe thing, you know, became big. Now I like ABS because it can take a little bit more of an impact, but at, what is it? 220 degrees for 15 minutes in a, oven. Guys, if you don't want to stay married, do this inside. If not, do it out on the grill outside, because it'll stink up the house. But you can use thermoplastics and even PVC pipe at a lower temperature, like less than 300, and mold it flat to be a quickie sleeve for machetes, for larger knives, even for thinner knives. And you know, all these kydex sheaths for these machetes and stuff, they become huge and thick, and you really don't need them that thick unless you're in like very, very cold instances. And even then, you can, after you've done this 220 degrees and smashing on a two inch PVC pipe flat between two boards to make a flat sheath, if you wrap that in Gorilla Tape, it can help with the impact even in cold weather too. So it's just a quickie sheath for, you know, big stuff. But I've even seen people do it for axes too, Kevin.
Yeah, someone had an axe cover that they did. I remember seeing that, and it probably was at Practice What You Preach, or maybe it was one of those events. But I think they made it out of like just 1-inch PVC pipe, and they cut it.
Yeah.
They cut a slit in it, and it just went over the top, and it was, again, duct tape everything. But it's just a great way of repurposing. You know, like Alan Odinson. I don't know if you've run across him. He's another South Carolina guy. Odinson, who's been on our podcast. He's helped out with a few of our events. He makes bows out of PVC. And he always,
oh, dude, incredible. Don't get me started.
So you probably have met him. You met him at Blade Show probably. So yeah, he always says like people throw away PVC and they don't realize the resource that they have. You know what I mean? Like that is such a very useful item that you can find in any home, you know, and you can make things out of it. So I just love that idea.
Listeners, real quick, make sure you wash the PVC pipe out if you get it from the backyard, because if it's been used in plumbing or something, you're going to have like a shitty, a cruddy machete. And, you know, so you want to clean the inside of it with dishwasher soap or something if you don't know where it came from.
what's your favorite repurposing or recycling that you've seen someone do, you know, in the jungle?
Oh, man. Well, let's see. There's probably definitely anywhere from the grocery bag cordage, where, you know, I learned this from Gorn in the course. I tried to be a little bit guarded with that. I finally put it on YouTube, and then like 500 other people yanked that there, and I'm pretty darn sure nobody's ever seen it anywhere else but there. And I actually asked some of the guys who went and did it, and they were like, yeah, we were inspired by your video. But I learned it from my friend down there. He learned it from people who were in a Caribbean jail, where you can take plastic bags and make like ridiculous tensile strength cordage to the point where you can probably garrote people. I'm sure of it, because we took the wrapper that was around the top of a 2-liter Coke bottle down there, and he made cordage out of it. And I still have this piece of cordage. I can do chin-ups off of it.
Yeah.
So that's really cool. So that's, I mean, the grocery bag, Kevin, is on every single continent in the world. Mm-hmm. So you have a chance to find that really, really well. Heating up the 50-gallon blue plastic drums, I've seen them repurpose everything from fixing the PPE kayaks. I don't know how they get it to bond, but they got it to bond, all the way to making knife handles out of it. Mm-hmm. So that blue stuff is really, really cool. Tarps down there are a little bit harder than normal. So they'll piece together Tyvek and PVC and whatever they can find to have like patch style covers for, you know, certain things to cover stuff. So there's always a myriad of things down there, like tiki torches. I'll probably buy another tiki torch again, but they used to just cut beer cans up or soda cans up, mount them with tire wire to the top of saplings, and then just put a rag in there with kerosene, and you'd get a beautiful, beautiful torch that way. And that's just like their Monday,
man. Yeah, they're I, just talking to Jason Smith yesterday from Hobo Forge. We were talking about reusing and recycling and you know, not throwing things away right away, and always amazed by that stuff. But we're rounding up this podcast. We're almost done with it. But of course, there's one topic we haven't talked about, and it's your namesake. It's Joezilla. And I gotta ask you some Godzilla questions.
All right, go for it. I'm down for that. You know, I used to like be, you know, a little bit more quiet about it, but like, I swear to God, Kevin, you tell people at Blade Chill you're in a Godzilla, and it's almost as bad as telling people you did martial arts.
Well, there's a new
you're in there for like 2 hours.
Yeah, there's a new generation of it. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, yeah, if you say, hey, I'm into Batman, are we talking Keaton? Are we talking Batfleck? Mm-hmm. Are we talking, you know, Christian Bale? Are we talking Adam West? Like, there are multiple generations of it, right? So what was your generation of growing up with Godzilla? Was it like the dude crushing the, like in the bad rubber suit in Japan with like Mothra on wires? Like, because you were Joezilla before like all the CGI, right? Like the Matthew Broderick movie?
Oh yeah, yeah. The newest one came out, and guys, I promise I won't go on a rant too hard, everybody, but I appreciate your patience. The newest Godzilla came out in 2014. Since I was a 90s kid, I got all these like bootleg VHSs of the Heisei series, which is like a time in Japan when it's like the 90s, where you could still see the piano wire, you know, holding up the Mothra or the Ghidra or the monster's, you know, wings and stuff. And they would paint piano wire to match the background. And I actually used that trapping one time down the Amazon. It wasn't like, you know, use paint, but using mud on like certain spots to mirror the back of the trees that the line was kind of next to and stuff. But it was a 90s thing, but I was always into Godzilla ever since I was like, I think 5 years old in the 80s too. And, you know, here's this giant monster that forces people to learn to, you know, have more respect for nature and have to get together to fight a big outcome. So I think that was, I don't know, very inspiring to me. Plus I just like, you know, a giant monster wrecking giant cities and stuff. That's reptilian.
Yeah. There were some interesting interpretations of Godzilla over the years. And, you know, I think the funniest one is in the new Jackass, when it's not a Godzilla walking down the street, it's something else, which we're not going to talk about, but it's
I'll check it out.
Oh dude. And when you see this, you're gonna be like, that is so ridiculous. You're going to feel like you're back in high school again with the level of maturity, but I don't care if you are.
I never left that level of maturity.
Yeah. No kidding. Right. Like when I saw this, I laughed out loud. I'm like, I shouldn't be laughing.
You just went to Doug Meyer's place, right?
I sure did.
Oh man, I've known him forever. And he's, of course, you saw how amazing of a flint napper he is. I kind of want to do a bushcraft class where he has to flint nap me a tomahawk made like in the style of like Godzilla versus Kong. And I'm forced to use that to like try and get out of my skill set. Well, I think that would be awesome.
What I want to do here in North Carolina is I'm going to create a guest instructor series where I'll talk to you about it offline. But basically, I want to bring in like guys like you. I want to bring in Doug Meyer. I want to bring in, you know, Jason Smith for a day, right? Like just like a day long course where it's like 9 to 5, and people will come and they'll train with, you know, friends of mine who I respect, you know, and friends of mine who have different skill sets that, you know, maybe they're interested in. But I want to base that out of this office here because we have all the resources that we need
to
teach.
All right. So when are we doing a big knife Rambo class?
Dude, I will do that class.
It's called the Rambo class, and you're forced to no knife under like 10 inches.
Yeah. So yeah, that class, I'll tell you, I already did the groundwork for it. You know, I went to Hope, British Columbia in 2015 and again in 2016, and I brought a Newt Martin MCE2 knife, which is his interpretation of the First Blood knife. And I took the cordage off the handle and I made bird traps. And like, I'll tell you, it's fun. I would love to do that. Maybe we'll see. But We got to go. We got stuff to do. So I need to have you tell everyone, where can they find you? What's coming up with you? And some parting words, like what you want to leave the listener with.
Let's see. You can find out about me under Joe Flowers Bushcraft Global on Instagram. I have to update my website today, but bushcraftglobal.com. CondorTK.com, Tops Knives, Artisan Cutlery, CGRB, all those.com, Instagram, all that fun stuff. You'll be hearing some new stuff coming up. We're going to be giving out the date of our classic Bushcraft Global class coming up. I have some more hardcore classes in Colombia, Trinidad, and possibly Florida, just depending, and some team ups with Georgia Bushcraft. I'm including some river trips up here in North Carolina. So basically just Instagram is probably the best place to follow, on Facebook as well. So all the normal stuff.
Sounds good, man. Well, hey.
And where do we find out about your book?
Oh my God. Well, I mean, you guys, if you're listening, you want my book, you can go on Amazon. You can go on a Fieldcraft site. You can come and get it here in Aberdeen. You can probably find it at Barnes & Noble.
The Kindle edition is on sale too, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it's read by a dude named Matthew Boston. So it's actually not my voice reading it, but I'll tell you, I've said the story before. The original person they wanted to read my book, you know, it was like 101 skills. And I was like, that is not me. Like, like I was like, absolutely not. You know, they're like, what do you think of this guy? He's really well known. And I was like, not me. And then they said this other guy, I'm like, okay, he sounds like a dude that, you know, would be by the fire. You know,
I would love to have Terrell do an audiobook.
Oh, yeah.
Imagine with his old voice. And
yeah, he's anyway, like, he's like the second most interesting man in the world. And you know, what's the expression? his voice, sounds like smooth velvet.
Yeah, that would be a great way of describing it for sure.
Hey, man. Hey, stay on. But guys, thank you so much for listening to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. Check out Joe Flowers stuff that he's doing with Condor and with Bushcraft Global. And, you know, if you happen to catch him, grab his ear for a while because he's highly animated. He's probably going to be all over the place, but you're going to love to hear what he has to say. So, Joe, thanks so much again for staying on.
No problem.
All right.